Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today, Cindy, this is one for the birds.
Yes.
It's not about baseball, though baseball is coming.
Oh, those are good birds.
It's about, something, frankly, I know that you and I both love to cook and eat. Birds.
Very much. Very much.
So, and I think people certainly are very accustomed to dealing with chicken, though there are some mysteries about chicken. But there are a whole lot of other birds worth playing with out there, mm-hmm. worth roasting and grilling and sautéing. And
right, with access that you have through ordering online now, you can get anything you want. I mean, it's if your local butcher doesn't have it or if for some reason can't get it for you, which it's always nice to be able to see it in real life before you buy it. You want to make sure things are nice and fresh. Birds are volatile just like seafood. It's a poultry. They need to be stored nice and cold, very, very cold, close to freezing. And they need to be nice and fresh. Needs to smell good. Needs to smell like, it's with a lot of things, checking for freshness is common sense. Checking for, does it smell good? Does it look good? Does the color seem good? Is it slimy? Yeah, we don't like slime, do we? Nope. And definitely don't want any of our fish or our birds to be that way. So if you are able to check it out from the butcher or you just trust your butcher, then great. If not, I'm sure you can find it online somewhere.
Now, you have a little pet chicken, I'm about to say.
What?
You have a chicken, a smaller roasting chicken, that comes from a particular source that you like. And there are a couple of sources. Let's knock out the chicken out of the gate. Okay. What do you prefer?
The little birds, Poussin is one of it's just such a great opportunity, particularly for us where I work, because our portions are smaller, and half of a Poussin is really a good portion for us, so that way I can serve the breast and the leg meat. And we also get what's called a green circle chicken. It's a chicken that's produced by farmers, and they're fed in such a way that they're eating really, really kind of like great table scraps from good restaurants. It's kind of amazing what these birds get to eat. And of course, like with all livestock, the better the environment that the bird or animal grows up in, the healthier the environment, the healthier the bird, the happier the bird, the better it is to eat. Less stress, better it is to eat. So take it out of its cage and put it out and let it live a normal life. It's going to be a whole lot happier and a lot better to eat. So the smaller birds are nice because, again, let's say, it's two of you at home or maybe even four of you at home that you're cooking for. These portions lend itself to having a great green salad first course, or maybe you have, smoked salmon, or you made it a terrine or something that you want to have first course, then you can end up with this slightly smaller bird portion. So the whole thing with roasting any kind of chicken is getting good caramelization, seasoning it well. That's inside and out. In the cavity, out of the cavity.
So let me back you up a tiny bit. A Poussin, we might refer to Poussin in English as it's a young chicken, but spring chicken, literally.
Mm-hmm.
They're smaller. They're going to be less fatty. You have to really nail it when you cook them, or they can be dry.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And I know a lot of people, because they're maybe not experienced cooks or not cooking things over and over and over again like we do, you live in this fear because we all want to be healthy and not make ourselves sick through eating food or make anyone else ill, is that you want to cook it all the way through. But cooking it all the way through, if you go past that, it's going to be dry, which you also just, were talking about. So, let's really always, the best way to check to see if a chicken is done is to just lightly pierce the leg meat with a little paring knife, the end of your paring knife. And if the juices are clear, that means there's no blood in there. It's done. And then the more you cook something, the more when things are done.
Yeah, I think that if you're using a thermometer And it's certainly a good idea to use a thermometer. You don't check the breast, you check the leg. The thing is, mm-hmm. when the leg is completely done, the breast may be dry because it's going to go faster.
Right, right. So when you're seasoning the bird, that can be as simple as light salt and pepper on the inside and salt and pepper on the outside. You could put a little couple pieces of fresh thyme in the cavity. You could put citrus in the cavity. I like orange with chicken. You could do lemons. And, you know, you could also put a little mirepoix in there, you know, sort of sliced onion, shallot, a little bit of carrot. If you love garlic, you could put a couple of garlic cloves in there. And it just sort of perfumes the bird as it roasts in the oven. You can start at 350 degrees and then for about 15 minutes and then knock it down to 300 for the rest of cooking. And if you see you're not getting really great color, you can bump up that temperature back up before the end of cooking as well to get some good caramelization on the outside of it.
You know, the methodology that I prefer always begins like a heavy pan on the range, because mm-hmm. you know me, I like fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always shallots and garlic in that cavity. And the classic dish, the poulet d'estragon, you rub everything with lots of fresh tarragon, and especially use it. Eventually you'll use more in finishing the bird. But if you put the garlic and the shallots in the cavity when it starts, eventually what happens is as the fat is rendered from the chicken and goes into the pan, the shallots and the garlic, honestly, from time to time, because you're turning it to brown on all sides, they fall out. And when they fall out, they flavor that fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you slip them back in there. And then you baste the bird with that fat. And it kind of happens again and again. And when you're browning on the range, if you use a little bit of tarragon vinegar to... Well, it could just be white wine vinegar. A little bit of tarragon vinegar to just give it a little brush and then baste with that. The browning will stop pretty well, and you can just slip that guy into the oven, like you said, 300, 325, and let it finish out.
Mm-hmm. The basting is big. I mean, you know, we talk about turkey. I immediately thought of turkeys when you said that. That's a long cook time. You want to keep that skin crisp, moving in the direction of being crisp. With what you're basting with is basically fat, as you said, that's coming out of the bird, and there's some juice as well. And but yeah, basting is an important process, and also. You know, we often are cooking on a sheet pan, which is a shallow vessel to cook in. At home, you're talking about cooking in cast iron, Tony, and that's the beauty of cooking at home. It, you know, you have this one dish that you're going to, you know, you can literally serve everything out of, and you've introduced vegetables into that dish. You had vegetables in the cavity, then you add vegetables at the end. Cooked in all that fat and juice, and you know, really, really capitalize on that. Maybe you're adding near the end of cooking parsnips to that pot. You know, some other vegetables, turnips if you like them, yeah. Brussels sprouts. I mean, all kinds of things could.
Carrots, golden beets.
Mm, yeah, beets that are already cooked, by the way.
So,
yes,
Cindy, let's swap to smaller birds.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go to some of the. I think the trickiest one. To me, it's got to be pheasant. Pheasant
lean.
Is marvelous, but man, it's lean.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my goodness, it's trickier to deal with. The skin is thinner. There's less fat under the skin.
Oh my gosh, and there are all these little tiny millions of little bones on the leg too. So just be conscious of that when you're working with it, because you know, if you are, say, deboning it, you want to make sure you lose every one of those little bones. But pheasant is delicious. Just don't overcook it. So, you know, be very careful in that cooking process. I might suggest that you, if you can, of course you can roast the whole bird, or you might be really successful taking the legs off and confiting them, and which is nice because especially since that is a leaner bird, to add that fat to the process.
That's a good solution because you end up, when you confit it or if you braise it, you're going to pull the meat and then use them in a different way. Use them mm-hmm. in a fricassee or something with mm-hmm. the first chanterelle mushrooms that are coming up, which would be pretty fun to have.
Right. We are about to get our first blonde morels in this week. I am so excited, Tony. It's funny, we were just talking about them. And the first wild ones from Oregon are coming in tomorrow. And that with those gorgeous morels with the pheasant would be fantastic. Mm. You know, saute them in a little butter with a little bit of fresh thyme in the pan, salt and pepper, and let those caramelize just a little bit. And that would be a little bit of cipollini onions or pearl onions or roasted garlic and maybe some carrots. And
the morels with the roasted pheasant breast, that sounds great to me. That's you know, we talked about getting to Bordeaux later in this program, and that some of the richer white Bordeaux, the wines from Pessac, are really not just Graves, but Pessac Lyonnais, and there are famous ones that are super pricey, but there are other ones that are marvelous that are not wild priced, like a Malocque de la Gravière would be super with pheasant with morels.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we also have crawfish in today. And I could also see adding a little bit of crawfish tail meat to that pheasant course with the morels. One of the other things that would be fun for our folks at home, because it's so simple, is to do a Dijon cream sauce for something like that as well. You know, super easy. Heat up a little bit of cream, you know, add a touch of salt and pepper, whisk in a little creamy Dijon mustard at the end, and that would be delicious with that, you know, whole, either your chanterelles that you were talking about or morels. And man, that would also be good with the crawfish.
Just not too much mustard, and
no,
and yeah. Two, I guess maybe I think instinctively a little stock for some body.
Sure, but I was trying to make it easy, and yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you have a little stock at home,
yeah, it's funny. It's the having stock around thing is a little bit addictive. My 8-year-old, this is a very tangential. We're making pasta brunch on Sunday. And so, of course, you know, she wants to discuss the sauce with me. And it's tomatoes and roasted mushrooms and like spicy sausage. She's like, Dad, it needs some stock.
Wow. So. Yeah, so when she's 16, she's going to start working in one of the kitchens, I think. Yes. She'll be ready.
Know, she's probably going to do whatever she wants to do.
Giving her a great head start.
She is.
Oh, of course.
In charge.
Well, so yeah, with pheasant, and then you have birds like the squab, which is a totally different end of the spectrum as far as flavor goes, and just rich and sweet, though. That's one of the cool things about birds. They have a sweet tone to them naturally.
They do. When we get into our next segment, let's talk about red meat birds, because that's a different thing. I'm going to throw a little plug in here for my very favorite white meat bird, which is guinea fowl, which is a treat to roast. Guinea fowl is the opposite of the pheasant. It's got a lot more fat under the skin and has a tremendous amount of flavor. And if you roast that patiently and baste it nicely and season it well, oh my goodness, that rewards. And even just roasting it with a little bit of rosemary or when you know, your all-time favorite black truffles, when black truffles are in season, putting little slices underneath the skin, any other sort of fun things to toss in there that you want to, go for it. But just the guinea fowl itself, its flavor and the flavor that comes from the fat and the amount of flavor that skin takes on, crisping in that fat, roasting in a pan, is nuts. And that's a very good meal for a family of four, or a very rich one for a family of two.
Right. On Sunday, for service, I roasted a guinea fowl. And when I went to pull the breast meat off the bird, there were still just these gorgeous pockets of golden fat right near the wing underneath that skin. And I just pulling that off and looking at it, I'm like, oh, this is why this is so good. And I served it with wild porcini risotto, which I made with dried porcinis, because we don't have porcinis right now. And that, oh my gosh, again, that sort of earthy, gorgeous, ethereal almost flavor of those porcinis and that risotto, and then the bird and the fat. And also I had a squab and guinea fowl and Rohan duck in house. So I had all these beautiful bones to make a great stock. Oh my gosh. And all I did was make a broth with it. Usually I would take that stock and reduce it down and make a sauce, but I'm like, no. All this really needs is this beautiful, sweet, gorgeous stock. And, you know, we served it with a spoon, and here you have this risotto, this beautiful, gentle, you know, gorgeous guinea fowl breast, and that broth. And that was a nice Sunday dinner for folks, I think.
I would think so. And guinea fowl is the one white meat bird that wants red wine, gentle red wine. And maybe Bordeaux red wine again, you know, something not a giant vintage and not one of the really dense Cabernet Sauvignon-driven wines. but maybe Saint-Emilion, softer year, 2011, 2017, 2004. Those are all things that will show up, especially if you've done anything to intensify the flavors, let's say reduced stock into a more serious sauce or have additional roasted elements. You can do something that has a bit more power, but a relatively gentle red Bordeaux would work nicely.
Sounds good.
When we come back on Formidable Phone Food and Wine, Cindy, I hope you're ready. It's red meat birds, everybody's favorite. On Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR.
Support for WIPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy and I are talking about birds today, roasting them, eating them. It's funny, I don't know. When a bird is cooked really well, it makes me happy. I want to eat it. I want to drink the proper glass of wine with it. And we've got to move into red meat birds. What in the world is a red meat bird?
Well, one of the best is squab. I would describe quail as a red meat bird as well, and magret. So these are all birds that have, the potential, like magret with all that gorgeous skin and nice fat under the skin. Magret to me is sort of like eating a great steak, a great beef steak.
And you're talking about a magret duck breast.
Right. The magret is a cross between a mallard and a Muscovy bird. And their meat is very red. The breasts are quite large. And like I said, the fat cap on top underneath the skin is just one huge, just gorgeous layer of fat that needs to be scored with a sharp knife. Do not go down to the meat. Just gently cut through the fat and the skin and score it. And then that way you can gently cook out some of that fat because you don't need it all and brown it lightly in a pan and then flip over and saute the meat in that beautiful fat that you just rendered out.
I will admit that every time I render out that duck fat to cook my gray at home, I always save the duck fat and then use it for the turkey burgers to make them.
Oh, good. That's
to make
nice.
Them less healthful, but a whole lot more satisfying than it would be on their own.
And I like to pull out that beautiful fat and make parmesan with it, which is a thin sliced potatoes cooked in a cast iron pan and a thin layer with salt and pepper. And just you brown both sides. Like it's only like 3 layers of potato, so it's not that thick. And you can brown both sides and still cook the potato, finish it in the oven. Oh, so good. But magret is one of the greatest birds ever.
That parmesan would be a nice accompaniment for a piece. So talk about searing a piece of magret. You talk about rendering the fat from it, and so then to finish it and to what point it wants to be cooked.
Sure. Flip it over, start to sear it and cook it nicely in its own fat, and then pop it into a 400-degree oven. If you have convection, go ahead and turn it on and let it cook to medium rare. It will take 4 to 5 minutes. It's a pretty fast process. And let it rest. Absolutely let that bird rest before you slice it because it will really give off a lot of blood otherwise. So let it rest for 5 or 6 minutes and then nice thin slices. I season it very simply with salt and a little bit of pepper. You could certainly wave around a little rosemary in that fat before you go into the oven, but I wouldn't put the rosemary in the fat in the oven. If you do anything, maybe sit it on top of the bird as it sits and roasts in the oven. But really, that's all, you really medium rare or medium rare to medium is all the further you'd want to go with that. A little like a piece of, New York strip or a ribeye. I think you really want to stay, if that's how you eat those meats, then the magret, you would want to stay with the same temperatures.
Yeah, the reality is the fat is pretty much all on the outside. So if you take it much past that, it starts to get pretty tough. Mm-hmm. And once you get past like medium well towards well, it'll actually seem a little bit gamey.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it doesn't particularly seem gamey. It just seems, and the blood is sweet on those birds.
Yeah, so good.
About a decade ago, maybe a little more than a decade ago, I was in the southwest of France. So in Bordeaux, but also in Marigny and Cahors on a trip. And I had 7 meals in a row with different wine producers.
Oh, I thought you were going to say
with
birds.
7 meals. This was in March. Well, hang on. This was in March. And I was served Magret every single time.
Oh, wow.
And an entire Magret every single time. So those are usually, 14, 16 ounces, something like that.
Yeah. And, yes.
And some version of Pomme Dauphinoise, right?
Wow.
And then dessert was always, there. Besides the potatoes, there were no vegetables at all. This is like definitely, cardiologic emergency by southwest of France. And the dessert was, they were all duck fat made crust crab apple tarts, because crab apples had just come. And
how fun.
The first meal, I loved it. And the second meal was quite good. When I got to the seventh meal in a row in 4 days, it became a lot.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to become a duck.
You Wines said the whole the Southwest,
Magret. Yeah, the entire Magret. So I ate which 7 pounds of Magret.
Both breasts, which is crazy. That is a huge portion. Yeah, it's, as you said, they're a pound. Every time I buy Magret, it comes in whole. It's a pound. Wow, that's crazy. Well, okay, you ought to know a lot about Magret now, Tony.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so Tony.
I definitely learned about pairing wine with Magret, okay? Cahors, it works.
Of course.
Madeira, a little too tannic for it.
Okay.
When I got down to to Grave and Pessac, those 50-50 Cab Merlot blends that are pretty sophisticated, delightful with. Mm. Pomerol, dead on, definitely my favorite. There's a sweetness and a certain irony, minerality to those wines. And Pomerol are that neighbor of Centimiglion that's almost entirely Merlot. But oh my goodness, it was like, okay, every day. It's like wine pairing school on Magret of Duck.
That's good. I need you to tell the story about the first time you had the squab at Ma Cuisine as we move on to squab as a bloody bird.
Oh, so yes, at a restaurant called Ma Cuisine in Bonn, a big favorite over the years. One of their signature dishes is a very particular squab dish. Squab is pigeon, but a bit younger, so it's more tender and a little bit less gamey, though it still has good intensity of flavor. And squab, you want to cook it like the duck, or maybe even a little bit less. Medium rare is as far as you want to take it for sure. And it's unusual. But the first time that I had it, I was shocked by the flavor. And it was definitely, and you said this in an almost comic way. I don't know how else to describe it to you besides, like, if someone looked up a recipe in a book and was making it at home, like a home cook's semi-Asian, meaning that there's soy in that and there's a little sesame oil in that, and there's some kind of vinegar I could never quite identify, and whatever the marinade is, but that bird really got perfumed with that seasoning, and oh man. And it's just cooked between two black steel pans for, I don't know, how many minutes would you guess? Maybe 6?
Probably, yeah, 6 or 5. Yeah, it's quick. Yeah.
And then rest it.
It's one of the best things I've ever eaten.
It's a ridiculous thing. And it's just,
I think there is two,
totally
actually.
Simple. It's totally simple. But literally, marinate the bird. Both the pans are hot. Put it in the pan. It's a little bit like pollo alla mattone, the way that she would cook it. And remember the first time that you had it, after me bragging about it, you're like, yeah, whatever. I'm sure it's fine. You immediately ordered a second one.
Yes, I did. I'm like, I need to eat that again.
Yeah.
She's a remarkable chef, and that restaurant is tiny. I mean, to put it in context, what are there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 tables in that restaurant?
Something like
one
that.
One big one in the middle. Yeah. It's a tiny place, and I mean, and her kitchen, I know her kitchen is really tiny, and it's just remarkable what they can produce out of that very, very small space. And they feed a whole lot of winemaker people that come from all over the world to eat in that beautiful village, in that beautiful restaurant.
It's a very simple restaurant. Ma cuisine means my kitchen. And there's several things there that are destination worthy, but not in a fancy way. And you literally are like sitting at a kitchen table. That being said, Pierre has a foolishly well-stocked cellar, and his knowledge is excellent. You know me, I'm not so good about taking wine advice from other people. And Daniela Labogravière and Pierre at Ma Cuisine, those two, they know what's up. They know what's up.
Right.
Hey, Sin. Speaking of backing up to Muscovy ducks, who doesn't like duck leg confit?
Everyone likes duck leg confit, I think, that eats birds.
You want to tell a little bit of the history of the dish?
Yeah, it's
what
it's,
the point was.
You know, it comes back to the days before refrigeration, and you know, for all the lifetime of cooking that's been going on, people have had to figure out how to eat when things are not available, like in the wintertime. And so they had to figure out how to preserve things, and that's why we have these beautiful preserved hams all over, you know, Spain and here in the United States and other countries. And so with confit, it's a way of preserving the duck leg so that you can eat it months later. If you back in the day when they would just store them in the ground in a cool place, or in a cellar in a cool place, or maybe you had a spring house and you that's where you stored your potted or jarred things. So it needs to be immersed in fat. That the enemy of freshness is air, moisture. And so we don't want things to mold. We don't want things to dry out. And by encasing it in fat, that does that for us. It achieves what we need to achieve to preserve. And
ducks have a tremendous amount of natural fat. And
yes.
It can be, like we talked about with the duck breast earlier, you can render that fat off. And it takes a quantity of fat in order to make duck leg confit. But first step is seasoning it, right?
Right. So bay leaf, peppercorns, a little bit of red wine, thinly sliced onion, it really is a great start. Garlic, cloves, just sort of let it salt. Let it all just toss it all around in a dish and let it sit for, you know, overnight. And then the next day, immerse it in fat and cook it. And when I say red wine, I mean just a little bit dabbed around.
Well, and it's refrigerated overnight. And then what you need to do is that, it's funny, I have an old Staub confit pot that probably holds four legs or something like that. That's several quarts. And it's kind of a tall, skinny pot. And you fill it with a pretty good level of fat. And Lord knows during the shutdown during the pandemic, I made confit. And that was fun. And did one with rosemary and star anise for seasonings with garlic.
Oh, that's nice.
And that worked really
nicely. That's very unusual. I like it.
It was time to play around. I made four different kinds of French fries in that pot.
So the idea is that you cook it on very, very low heat for a long period of time. So say 260 to 275 degrees. The duck is immersed in the fat. It has to be absolutely covered. And you don't want to see it. Like, it should never simmer. It should obviously never boil. You'll
never
destroy
brown it.
So, right. Never let it brown in that process, low and slow, like so many things that are so very good in cooking.
Yeah, like so many things that are duck, you're still looking at Bordeaux wines and still looking at probably richer, softer, even like an Ome Duc or Bordeaux Superieur from a good year, like 18, would probably be delicious with confit. But it's got good flexibility wine-wise, for sure. Other kinds of duck, Cindy?
I started working with Rohan ducks probably about a year ago, and they're more typical, you know, sort of with the layer of fat that probably people think about versus the magre naturally. So, and you know, take that with a grain of salt when I say that, but it the birds roast really beautifully. I found that the legs do cook sort of nicely with the breast. In other words, once the breast is done, once the legs are done, I don't feel like either one are overcooked. I like to put a little bit of orange slices, fresh thyme, sliced carrot. And once you have that in the cavity, then you can roast the bird at 325 degrees. It's about 25 minutes to get to a nice, pretty medium on the breast and the leg cooked. And just then let it rest, you know, quite a bit before you think about slicing. I think you're going to be really excited about all the different things you can do with the breast meat and the leg meat on that bird.
It's also a really, really good bird to make a duck terrine from.
Yeah, it'd be delicious.
If that's your jam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Cindy, these are definitely all things I love to eat. Oh, my goodness. When we come back on Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine, let's talk about something I love to drink. Let's talk Bordeaux wines. I'm going to do a bit of a primer, and I know, Cindy, you've got some questions for me, don't you?
Absolutely.
On Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we needed to get quail taken care of, right?
Yes.
So how would you describe quail compared to some of the other birds?
Well, first of all, it's really little. So it's the smallest of all the birds. It's a little bit smaller than the squabs that we get in. So we typically serve them whole, which is nice because then you get the advantage of it remaining on its bone structure and the flavor of the bones and just sort of leaving it intact like that, not puncturing it in any way, just keeps in all the juices and it can just be really incredible. So what we like to do is sear it off in the pan first. So because it is such a little bird, you want to get some caramelization going and you really kind of need to hit the pan first with that. So a saute pan, high heat, little bit of neutral oil like corn or canola coating the bottom of the pan, and then kind of hit all sides of the bird, the legs, the breasts, the back. You do season it lightly with salt and pepper inside the cavity, outside on the skin, prior to doing anything. I would also back up and say, when you're working with any bird, just a reminder, I think we talked about it at the beginning, but, you know, wash them inside and out first. You want to make sure there isn't any, and also make sure there aren't any of the body parts inside oftentimes, particularly with, yeah, that would be a bummer. Oftentimes with squab or pheasant and certainly chicken for sure, they will leave the liver part.
It's a little bag of goodies.
Yeah, it's a goodie bag for sure, and it's often wrapped in plastic, sometimes in some sort of special paper, but oftentimes in plastic. So you do want to check out that cavity, remove that. Sometimes they stick things in the back of the neck as well, particularly on a turkey, because it's such a big bird, and that's a pretty good sized cavity. They can put the giblets and things in there. So do that, check that, wash it with cold water, of course, and absolutely no soap or any other solution in case you've never cooked before and don't know what it means when we say wash something out, and then pat it dry. You don't want any of that liquid in there. Inside and out, which will also pull some of the bloody parts that might be in there. Sorry for saying it that way. And then season it. And then when you're ready to cook, put your pan on, nice stainless steel pan, hopefully heavy duty, a little bit of neutral oil, and begin to brown that bird, pop it in the oven. I would, you know, anywhere between 350 and 400, kind of depends on how properly your oven's working. You do want a bit of high heat because you kind of want it to cook relatively quickly. I wouldn't go any faster than 400 though. And then cook it until it's medium. Squab, I always cook rare to medium rare. That bird just loves that. It's better that way. Pheasant, guinea fowls, we cook all the way through until they're with maintaining moisture, not overcooking and drying them out. But with quail, medium to medium well is really perfect temperature. If you start to go medium rare on quail, it's a little odd.
If you go past medium well, it's like super gamey. It just turns a corner.
Yeah perfect, you know. Medium is perfect.
One of those, like if you cook it to medium and it rests a little bit and goes up a tiny bit, then that's that's ideal. I'm gonna tuck back into what your description was on the preparation. Season the inside of the cavity as well as the outside. That's a big deal. Cindy, so quail garnishes, you know, some things want mushrooms, some things want fruit. What do you think about quail?
Oh, gosh, there's like a million. There are a million things I could put with quail. I love the idea of country ham and red grapes. It is sort of a southern and also sort of a, almost a little French dish as well with the grapes. And so I think that kind of answers the question. Country ham is nice and salty, and it's a wonderful pork product, and the grapes are fruit. So it does kind of show you the range. I also love pecan stuffing with quail. I love potatoes with quail. I like root vegetables with quail. So, you know, roasted baby carrots and cipollini onions or roasted shallots, a little bit of roasted garlic in with maybe a couple of different types of onions. Certainly mushrooms. Morels would be really good. Any kind of mushroom. But I definitely kind of tend to think, I guess, in the end, maybe like squash, like butternut squash fruit, pears, apples.
Quail's a little bit milder. Quail's a little bit milder than squab. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I think it does well with a little bit of a fruity accent. Or you said pears. Pears are great. Mm-hmm. I do love nuts with. Mm-hmm. So pears and hazelnuts or something along
cherries.
Those lines.
Oh, gosh. If we have Bing cherries in season, that would be really good with quail. Maybe toss in a little raspberry vinegar and just fresh on the plate. Or you could cook some port wine and a little stock reduction and add cherries to that on pickup. Oh, that would be good.
My quail, for me, it's funny. It's almost like an outlying bird as far as pairing things with it. They're really excellent Syrah from the Languedoc in the south of France. That maybe from the village of Pissenlit or maybe Saint Joseph in the northern Rhone Valley. Those things do really, really well with quail. But it's funny, and I don't love Syrah with a whole lot of other birds, but I do.
Okay.
Those Syrah-driven wines I love with quail.
That's great. Where is the Languedoc?
South France, west of Avignon.
Okay.
Close to the Spanish border, north of the Pyrenees. Not as far west as like Toulouse.
Okay. Languedoc. All right. Yeah. So I think that's good about quail. I mean, I think we've hit all the birds really, you know, sort of the fun ones that we like to work with. And, you know,
There are a bunch of others, but you don't run into partridge in the grocery store all that often.
Exactly. I think some of these things are most of these things are very accessible. And I think it should be fun for folks to try and work with them at home and experiment. And, you know, I think it gives you range in your cooking and opportunities. All right. So is it time to talk about the region of Bordeaux?
Yeah. We talked about doing a little bit of a Bordeaux primer. So,
all right.
Do you have questions about
Bordeaux?
I do. It's
Let's define the region. Where is it exactly?
I mean, it's in the southwest of France. Bordeaux, when you think about it, it's been a popular wine and sort of a big commodity wine, a well-traded wine, because especially in the 1800s, 17 and 1800s, the British really dominated shipping. When you think about it, Aquitaine in the southwest of France, where Bordeaux is sort of the heart of it, on the seacoast there and along the riverbanks, that whole area traded constantly, and a lot of land was owned by relatively wealthy British settlers, you know, ex-military, so on and so on. Mm. But those wines were heavily traded and became popular because of that, first and foremost, and because they can be excellent and live a very long time.
Okay. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, they're Bordeaux wines that I've had that were, you know, 100 years old, approaching 100 years old, that were still in very good shape. And other things, like we drank a 1971 Chateau Latour, not an A-plus vintage, but still a good vintage for Latour in particular. And that wine, you know, at age 50 or 51 a couple of weeks ago, delicious, right at its peak, and will hold there certainly for another 20, 25 years.
That's so amazing. So when you taste a wine that's like 100 years old, how is it different from, you know, a more current wine?
Well, something that's young, it used to be fruit just recently.
Right.
You know,
right.
So all of those flavors are dominant. Those are the primary flavors that are going to be there. A lot of the secondary flavors that as that fruit begins to fade, you know, it's almost like a half-life to slowly, and depends upon the grape and the region and all of that. Mm-hmm. But it depends upon, there's a balance that happens with the primary flavors fading and secondary flavors and aromas beginning to become more present. They were there kind of hiding, you know, but it's almost as though it's like the flower that blooms and then gets to the very best place and slowly decays is sort of the way that a wine ages. So when you've just had the bloom, you have an idea of what's there. You have a very small, very focused snapshot of what's there, but you don't know what's possible through time unless you're tasting it all the way through time. And things like the tannins, that sort of chalky business in your palate, and on the sides of your teeth and the sides of your mouth with big red wines like Bordeaux, those tend to fade through time. You'll see deposits precipitate from the wine onto the sides of the bottle. You can notice those even in younger wines sometimes. But those are just solids that are falling from the clear juice that's in there. But some tannin is carried with them as well.
So when you say secondary flavors, is that tannin, or what is a secondary
flavor?
So
let's say something has very black currant-y aromas or very blackberry aromas and flavors, and then as it ages, you'll notice there are more and more mineral notes that are there. The gravel that's there,
the down and dirty stuff,
low notes. I mean, when you think right. of flavors and aromas, you kind of go through levels. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a full orchestra. You have just in the string section alone, it's bass, cello, viola, violin, right? Mm-hmm. So in a wine, think about it. There are things underneath. There are things, you know, sort of in that baritone range, and then there are things that are kind of like full of voice, with more focus. And then high notes that kind of float above.
Okay. What are the grape varietals in that region? Let's go on to that.
So the most famous one for reds is Cabernet Sauvignon. The most widely grown is Merlot. But there's another Cabernet Franc, that's important. There's Malbec, and there's Petit Verdot. And they all bring different qualities, and they all want to be grown in different soils. And depending upon where in Bordeaux you are and exactly what soil types and conditions, different growers plant different grapes to get the best result. Where they plant the grapes, it's almost like tuning something. The right soil type will bring a grape to its best truth that translates the soil most successfully. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Cool.
So Merlot and Pomerol, one of the villages, a smaller one, and wines that I have huge affection for and that are a bit dear, I'm afraid. The Merlot there, and those wines are usually 90-95% Merlot. Mm-hmm. That they give you big, broad wines, great richness, really plummy fruit, very dark minerality that can almost run like iron, if that makes sense.
Yep. What are some of the houses in Pomerol that you like?
Oh, Bioschatel Certain. Chateau Le Gailly.
Oh, yeah.
A little house that's not as crazy expensive as some others that he's making super wines, and they're becoming better known and better reviewed, which will drive price, unfortunately, in the future. Chateau Feiticlinet, Feiticlinet, Feiticlinet. That, to me, is like a sleeper. Chateau Rougeau is also one that's a good value, Rouget. They're a whole bunch. The most famous, super expensive wine, Chateau Petrus, is a Pomerol wine, and those are at several thousands of dollars a bottle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Pomerol's neighbor is Saint-Emilion. Saint-Emilion is a lot of Merlot also, and Cabernet Franc, at times as much as two-thirds Cabernet Franc, but largely it's majority Merlot. Right nearby, better value than both, is the Côte Castillon, which is Merlot driven as well, sort of like little brother Saint-Emilion. And then the famous estates, the first growths like Chateau Lafite Rothschild, Chateau Mouton Rothschild, Chateau Latour, Chateau Margaux, they're all in the Médoc. And those wines, those the villages there, most of those are in Pauillac, the second northernmost of those villages. And that's gravelly soil, and those wines have great fortitude. North of that is Saint-Estèphe, more clay soils. You see more Merlot and blends, but that's like usually 60-40 Cab Merlot. And then south of there, Saint-Julien, just south of Pauillac, which is a little bit like Junior Pauillac in that there's a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon, but they're not quite as dense or intense or gamey as young wines. A little good introduction, Saint-Julien, to Cabernet Sauvignon-driven Bordeaux. South of that is Margaux, the village, and Chateau Margaux, the most famous estate in that village. But there are many excellent, softer Cabernet Sauvignon in that sandy soil coming from there. And then an area I particularly love, Pessac-Léognan, which is in the Grave, which is near the city of Bordeaux. Chateau Aubryon, the other first growth is there. Chateau La Mission Aubryon, and Chateau Les Carmes Aubryon. Les Carmes Aubryon, and those wines are about 50-50 Cab Merlot. Les Carmes Aubryon is the sleeper. That's a lot of Cab Franc, sometimes as much as 60% Cab Franc, and then Merlot and Cab. And those are softer, and the nose is very ethereal on those wines. The nose is very, very interesting, especially a little more exotic on the wines from Pessac.
What does first growth mean?
In 1855, there was a classification of estates in the Médoc, and first through fifth, and then cru bourgeois, right?
Okay.
And those are based on merchants' prices at that time. They were based on the potential of the estates. And largely, they're pretty accurate as far as, and the difference between the fifth growth and a first growth in price is enormous.
Okay.
The trick in buying is to find the fifth growth or the newly improved like third growth that outruns its price, let's say.
Okay.
Outperforms its price.
So as we know, Bordeaux can be very expensive. Where would you tell people to start?
I think it's most interesting. If you get a chance to taste things from different areas next to each other, it's crazy interesting. And even if it's more, even right now, you've got 18, 19, and 20 coming for wines. And you had 15 and 16 prior to that. And 17 is still a solid vintage. You have a lot of excellent vintages in the pipeline that are young wines that will give you an idea. Even modest ones from those years will give you an idea. But the more you begin to learn the regions through taste and comparison, through aromas and comparison, the more quickly you begin to learn that.
That's great. Thank you.
And of course. And yes, I completely skipped the white and the sweet wines. And remind me, we'll have to get to that as spring comes along.
That's great. Awesome.
And that's all we have time for on the Formidable Phone Food and Wine. If you want to listen to this program or any of our other podcasts, go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a full menu of goodies there. If you want to email correspond with us, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. And if you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. Thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday Morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School Woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.